Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Today, we talk about healthy eating and ultra-processed foods with our guest, Beth Olson, back with us, associate professor and extension specialist in the Nutritional Science Department at UW-Madison. Great to have her back. And as we talk with Beth, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about ultra-processed foods and maybe their nutritional value? Any tips for identifying ultra-processed foods at the grocery store? Do you use them? The number's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Beth Olson, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Always fun to be here.
So, how would you define ultra-processed foods?
Well, that's one of our tricky problems, Larry. There's no label for it, so a consumer can't, you know, go in and pick up a food and say, "Oh, this is an ultra-processed food." And one of the differences, if they're trying to pick foods based on dietary advice that we often give with ultra-processed foods, is it isn't actually about what we would usually talk about, nutrients, foods, how those foods work together in a diet. It's about how much that food is processed. So how much it's processed, how it's processed, how many processed ingredients. So I would say if you're concerned about your nutrition, we always, the use of ultra-processed food isn't very different from where we were before in terms of, you know, we're trying to encourage people to pick up more whole foods and fewer packaged foods.
Yeah. So my loaf of bread that I bought a couple days ago is not ultra-processed, I wouldn't think.
Well, it depends.
Oh,
so
boy.
That's what's really tricky about it is it's the ingredients. So if we just think about maybe making a food at home versus making one at the or buying one from the store, you might make a food at home and you use flour and sugar and water and, you know, if it's a bread, yeast or something else.
Mm-hmm.
If you're buying it at the store, they might be adding in, you know, an agent to stop mold or some other thing which would be considered a processed ingredient and make it an ultra-processed food. So I think for some foods, you know, the definition is pretty similar to what we've been saying. But for some foods, you're kind of in the middle of, it still might be quite a healthy food, a whole grain bread, whole grain cereal. And just because you make it at home doesn't mean that it's not healthy.
So what's the problem with ultra-processed?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. A lot of scientists are working on that. And there's kind of two trains of thought. One is some of those ingredients aren't ones we would typically have in our house. You know, historically, we wouldn't have consumed. So, you know, for decades, centuries, we've been eating sugar. But an ingredient like high fructose corn syrup as a sweetener, we haven't been using as long. So there's some concern that kind of all of those ingredients that are processed to add to manufacture foods for various reasons, maybe all those together are a problem. But the other one is, are we eating lots of those foods and we're pushing out some foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains that are good for us? So
okay.
Is it the foods or is it the absence of other foods?
So I'm trying to figure out how best to put this. So my loaf of bread, if it contained something that's going to make it good on the shelf for 2 weeks.
Yeah, it might be okay. You know, sometimes I think some of these ingredients, in my opinion, are relatively benign. So a common preservative is citric acid. Since it has an acidic quality, it inhibits the growth of some microorganisms. That's the same acid that's in citrus fruits. So I don't know that adding that as a trade-off for being able to buy that bread and have it for a while without it, you know, going moldy or whatever, you know, that might be worth it.
Robert in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I just thought I might share my little tidbit. During the 2 years of the pandemic, I lost 90 pounds because I started looking at the ingredients in the nutrition on the packaging of the food I buy in the grocery store. And I created this list of rules to follow. If the food I buy has more than 5 ingredients and any of the ingredients is pronounced in a way that I can't, is spelled in a way I can't pronounce, I don't buy it. I also don't buy anything with birch sugar or xylitol, anything hydrogenated, and anything with high fructose corn syrup, which they're cramming in everything. Because of this, I lost weight. I wake up more clearly. I'm sleeping better at night, and I highly advise anyone else to follow those simple rules.
Well, Robert, thank you for calling. Comment on Robert's idea with the 5 ingredients.
Yeah, it's fabulous that he found a way to eat healthy, and I'm assuming he needed to lose that weight and did, and he feels good. That's just wonderful. One can do that. I mean, certainly when you look at a product, if it has a very long, extensive ingredient list, it's probably a little further away from a whole food than closer to it. The one area you do want to be, I think, you know, be cautious is if ingredients sound foreign, but maybe they're not that bad. Citric acid's an example. Some of the vitamins that we fortify with or minerals have pretty long scientific sounding names, but it's just maybe vitamin B12 or vitamin C, ascorbic acid. So that's where I think you want to be careful. And you know, you're going to see that a lot in our fortified foods, grains, fruit, cereals, anything that is it's fortified. The other thing I would say is, I got to put my plug in here as someone who used to do research with dietary fiber and health. Take a look also at the nutrition facts panel, not just the ingredients list, and see, you know, does it contain fiber? Is it a whole grain and it contains fiber? Then maybe it's worth having some other ingredients added.
Ron in Wolf River will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I have a question about xanthan gum and guar gum. I notice that on every loaf of bread, every tortilla shell, even in something like Melinda's hot sauces, xanthan gum is in there. What is it, and why do we need it in all these foods?
Oh, boy. I think, not positive on all of those products, but a lot of those ingredients, the gums, there are also things like cellulose, are actually types of dietary fiber. Now, these aren't, you know, somebody didn't throw in a vegetable or a fruit. They're isolated from products, and they're used sometimes for things like thickening. Hmm. So it's really the sensory properties of the food that they're used. Again, you know, everybody can take a look at those ingredients, decide for themselves. For me, I'm a little less worried about the fiber additions because we don't eat enough fiber. And, you know, I'm less worried about those because generally they're natural ingredients, but they are isolated. I don't want to pretend they're, you know, dietary fiber out of nature put in. They're isolated from other products and put in for some sensory property like thickening. You'll see thickeners a lot in things like lower calorie salad dressing so that they're not watery. They put in a fiber that kind of thickens them up. Yep,
there we go. Thanks, Ron, for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. So lunch today is, for me, is a yogurt, an apple, and 2 nectarines, I think.
Wonderful. Well, there's probably no ultra-processed foods in those. Lots of whole foods, lots of nutrients, lots of protein, lots of fiber. You know, I'm big on that.
So I'm safe at least for lunch today.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
And we'll see how you get when you get to dinner.
Yeah. Well, dinner. I'll be on the road today. We'll be broadcasting from La Crosse tomorrow.
Ah.
So I'm probably going to be dining in a restaurant somewhere in La Crosse.
Yeah, and that can be a place where it's trickier for people. If they're eating out a lot, you know, eating fast food at lunch, picking up something through the drive-thru for breakfast, picking up something to take home, you might have what people would consider ultra-processed foods or foods that are, you know, a little higher in fat, a little less fiber.
So what are the scientists researching about the ultra-processed foods?
Well, what they're doing is they're looking at people's diets over time. They're classifying how many ultra-processed foods they have in versus ones that aren't as processed, and then looking at their health outcomes. So this is where some of the initial concern has come, that some populations have had as much as, or some subgroups in our populations, 80% of their foods coming from ultra-processed foods, and finding a higher incidence of, you know, higher weights, perhaps diabetes, heart disease. Again, is that because those ultra-processed foods contain something? Or is it because they're not eating less processed foods, which have a lot of health benefits? That's what they're looking at.
How the heck do they do? I wonder how how they manage to do that research.
Well, they look at food records or dietary recalls, different ways that people report their food. That itself is somewhat problematic.
Yeah.
You know, trying to remember exactly and how much you ate. It's also a little problematic in that since ultra-processed food definition has to do with how processed it is, there are some foods where people scientists aren't agreeing whether to put them in ultra-processed or not. So it can be tricky work. The other thing that's always hard to control for in those kind of studies is, as you can imagine, if someone eats a diet with lots of whole foods, what we might consider a very healthy diet, they probably also don't drink a lot. They may exercise more. They're a little less likely to be a smoker. So sometimes it's hard to pick out what's diet and what is all the other things that they're doing.
Kevin in Gays Mills, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Larry. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling in response to a previous caller who asked about xanthan gum and gar gum and foods. And used in place of flour to thicken the product. And if a flour was in there, then people with gluten sensitivities and celiac disease cannot have that. So in order to make a product gluten-free, they use the gar gums and xanthan gums in place of a little bit of flour.
You know, and Kevin has indicated he's celiac. So interesting point there, Beth.
Yeah, excellent point. I haven't looked a lot at the gluten-free products to see what they put in them. But I think that would be an interesting exercise, is to pick up some of those, look at the ingredient list, and see, what is being substituted in to accommodate those people who can't use those products that would have wheat. So great point. Excellent point.
Washington Post just had published a piece on gluten and gluten. People with, say, thinking they needed a gluten-free diet. And about, I think the research was like 80% of those who thought they needed a gluten-free diet it wasn't a problem, really.
Yeah. You know, food.
I'm not saying that for you, Kevin.
And, you know, something like celiacs is usually, you know, people get diagnosed. They get a procedure done where the doctor diagnoses it. But there are other gluten intolerance, there's other intolerances, and those are harder to diagnose, and often people self-diagnose. They eat something, they don't feel good, so they don't eat it again. You know, if they can manage that and still have a healthy diet, I think that's fine. I also think the food industry, and I used to work in it, so I know a little bit of how it works, you know, did a pretty good job of promoting a lot of products as gluten-free as if they had some special health benefit for the general population. And so a lot of people began to think they needed those products when they maybe didn't.
Jay in Lake Geneva, we'll go to you. Hi, Jay.
Hi, I just wanted to make a few comments also about what you were just talking about also. You know, gluten, you know, celiac disease, diabetes, those aren't like diseases that you just get. They're just different degrees of it. You know, you can have gluten intolerance at different varying degrees, and then it gets to a certain threshold where they call it celiac disease, where your gut's just not working anymore. Same thing with diabetes. It's insulin resistance is what it is. And the reason you get insulin resistance is because you're bombarding your cells with sugar. and insulin, and they start shutting down receptors. And the more receptors you shut down, the more insulin your pancreas tries to make, and the more receptors get shut down, eventually you get diabetes. And now the problem with that is by eating refined carbohydrates. So I think what your show should be talking about is not the term ultra-processed, but ultra-refined carbohydrates, because that's what's killing people. That's what's causing diabetes. And also, you should talk about the seed oils, too, the rancid seed oils that people are eating.
Well, rancid seed oils. Well, Beth, go ahead and comment.
Yeah, he brings up excellent points. We do have a lot of type 2 diabetes. I want to make clear that's different from type 1 that often can occur in childhood, which has nothing to do with how people are eating or weight. And they need insulin. But type 2 diabetes, a strong driver is overweight and obesity. So often people, again, might have trouble handling glucose, so they're pre-diabetic. And with care with their diet and with weight loss, they can control that without progressing on to type 2 diabetes. So there's some debate about whether eating those carbohydrates is what's causing that overweight and obesity. Is it carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates? Refined ones don't have a lot of fiber. Does that make them palatable so people eat too much? We don't really fully understand that, but we know eating diets with more fiber and being careful about weight gain can really work for helping people to reduce their risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Now, there is a genetic component to that, and there are some people who develop type 2 diabetes who are not overweight, and that's, you know, just something that happens.
And we'll get to the rancid seed oils in just a minute. Beth Olson, our guest, associate professor and extension specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. As we talk with her about processed foods, we've been looking at the ultra-processed foods, but taking some other questions as well relating to nutrition as we move along. You can join in, numbers 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at processed foods today on the show and zeroed in a bit on ultra-processed foods with our guest Beth Olson from the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have Beth back. Join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Just a quick mention, after noon today, we'll talk about technologies that help people with advanced heart failure. So that's at noon today. But right now, we're looking at food with Beth. The caller had a question or made a comment about rancid seed oils. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of people consuming a lot of rancid seed oils that it would cause a problem there. They would certainly develop an off flavor, and I would think people would notice that and not consume them. I know there's concern with seed oils, and some people think that we consume too much of them. One of the things we've done over the years, instead of just talking about how we should reduce certain fat levels in our diet, we've talked about the types of fats. And replacing some of the saturated fats, largely come from animals, with plant oils. Now, that would include seed oils, but we've also talked about ones that might be higher in omega-3. So avocados, fish. So these are monounsaturated fats, olive oil. So we've also talked about not just replacing your saturated fats with unsaturated, but looking at plant or others. But looking more at monounsaturated fats, because they also seem to be protective for heart health.
Yeah. Well, and here I'm thinking now we've zeroed in a little on ultra-processed food. Well, I would think oils would be an ultra-processed food.
Yeah, they might be. You know, that's interesting. I think Some might define it that way. Some of the scientists don't. And this is kind of this tricky part about ultra-processed foods. It's not just what's in the food. They actually talk about why. So if the sole purpose of the processing is to make the food more stable, and that would be true with oils, mm-hmm. or to make them edible, you know, we can't cook with a seed. We need the oil out of it. It needs to get extracted, crushed, pressed, whatever. Then they don't consider that ultra-processed. So you see the ultra-processed definition's a little tricky. Many of those scientists who are really looking at this talk about processed foods, and they talk about why they're processed, why the ingredients are used, and how they're packaged. So it's actually, they talk about the packaging as well. So you see that's not the food at all. So they're really talking about an entire category of a food as opposed to particular foods with ingredients in them.
Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have a question about grocery store vegetables.
Yeah.
Why isn't there more squash varieties? Why isn't there Swiss chard and other vegetables that we can consume the tops of? You know, why they throw away the good part?
Yeah. All right.
Well, that's probably a question for the food scientists. I'm not sure if that has to do with demand. And perhaps there's more of those at particular stores that cater more to people who are interested in that. Or if it has to do with transportation and how those foods bear up or season. I don't know. I do know, you know, stores, again, having worked in a food company, stores work on supply and demand. If it doesn't sell, they don't stock it. So perhaps some of those items just aren't moving quickly enough.
And I just saw something the other day about the profit margin or the margin that grocery stores work on. And it's like 1.5% or something like that. It's a very small compared to probably my Apple computers.
Yeah. It is a very tight margin. And so we would hear that word, and I worked in the food industry, and we'd want to put in a new product. Well, they didn't want to take out a product that they knew was selling well in order to make space for our new one that they didn't know about, because if it didn't sell, they weren't going to make money, and their margins are very slim.
I wonder if that's why you see new and improved.
Yeah, attract attention. So it might be the same product with a little bit of difference. I think it's also why you see, we used to call them line extensions. You know, people trust this product, so let's make it in another flavor or package it in a different way because people will be familiar with it and choose it. And that, you know, a lot of our food choices, you know, our familiarity, how we grew up, what we're used to. And one of the things we'll sometimes do an extension when we're doing nutrition education is just set a goal for the week to try something different. Try a new vegetable. You know, try it once. See how you like it.
Yeah. Here's an email. What beverages, if any, count as ultra-processed foods?
So I think not ultra-processed, I believe, are things like coffee, tea, and water. Most everything after that they consider processed. I think 100% fruit juice would not be processed. But energy drinks, fruit drinks, soda pops, any of the drinks that begin to add sugar, for instance, even blended fruit drinks where they're adding a very concentrated fruit juice to make it sweeter, they would consider that an ultra-processed food.
Mm. Milk?
Here again is that definition. Milk is not considered ultra-processed, even if it's pasteurized, because again, the purpose of that was just to prevent, you know, potentially dangerous organisms from being in the milk. Now, if the milk, probably chocolate milk's considered processed because we've added sugar generally and flavor. So then they would move that over into ultra-processed.
Some ultra-processed foods are made to overcome your body's signals indicating that you're full, which leads to weight gain. Maybe talk about some examples of foods where it may be difficult to tell whether you're actually full.
Yeah. One, you know, that we've caution people to take care over time are liquids. So you can drink very quickly something like a soda pop and not realize how many calories came in from that. So that's one area. I think, you know, anybody would probably be inclined to eat a food if it's tasty. So ingredients are added to make foods tasty. Fat and sugar, of course, salt. And those are all ones that are marked as, when they're added for that purpose, to make the food taste better, they're considered ultra-processed. So I think I often also think about how quickly can you eat the food. So if you think of how quickly could you eat a cookie versus an apple, it takes a pretty long time to get, you know, as you'll find out when you eat all your fruit for lunch, to chew it, swallow it. It's got fiber and it's going to move through you more slowly. Those might be a little less of something you're going to overconsume, as opposed to something that doesn't have much fiber, chews up pretty quickly, you know, moves through pretty quickly.
Yeah, that cookie goes pretty fast.
Yeah.
I don't have one today, but...
Yeah, it's a food I find sometimes you can almost take your last bite and not realize you were eating it. You know, you went so quickly.
So ultra-processing changes the chemical structure of food, and I'm wondering, how does that affect the way our bodies absorb the food?
Oh, that's a good question. So it could change it in that, again, if you take out the fiber, we're going to probably digest and absorb that more quickly. You're going to get the calories out of an apple pastry probably more quickly than you would an apple that has the fiber in it. So that's one. The individual ingredients, you know, we're changing them to some degree. Some of them we're just changing them. They're still ingredients you would find in nature. We've just added more of them or enhanced them. So your digestion absorption of those probably doesn't change much. It might be what it pushes out, like fiber. It might be how quickly it comes in. So refined carbohydrates are going to come in more quickly, raise your blood sugar, drop it again more quickly than something less refined.
Tom sent an email. How dangerous is acrylamide that is in food and can harm us if heated to a certain temperature?
Okay, I can't answer that one. That would be for the food safety person. I think that's in the plastics that people are concerned about. Certainly wouldn't be something I'd want to consume. But I think just something I'd have to look more at about exactly where it's coming from and how to avoid it if that's what we need to do.
And another one, what are some examples of foods that have altered chemical structures?
So high fructose corn syrup is an excellent example. It's a sugar that's processed to increase the amount of fructose. What that does is fructose is sweeter than regular sugar, sucrose, so they can use less of it and make something sweeter. So that's a real common change. Another one has been the oils. They are oils are liquid. So if you put them into a food that you want to stay more solid, it'll make the food runny. So they'll hydrogenate those oils. They add hydrogens on. It makes it more like a solid fat. To make whatever the product is more solid.
Oh, man. So what role can the government play in addressing health concerns associated with ultra-processed foods?
So they can do a few things, whether they choose to do so or not. You know, that's another question. They have made regulations over time. So when you think of trans fats, those can be produced when we hydrogenate fats, and the government decided there's no need for those in our food, and they said we can't put them in anymore, and they came out. So they can do things like that. They can also do more in terms of dietary guidance, nutrition education. They've done a lot with regulations around school meals, saying, you know, they have to be whole grain, how much whole grains need to be in, how many fruits and vegetables can be in. So they can do a lot with those kind of programs, other government programs like WIC that provide foods for low-income families with small babies and children. Where we haven't gone is things like, you know, actually just forbidding certain ingredients as long as they're considered safe, or forbidding advertising. That's just not something that's been done in the U.S.
I wonder how much corn syrup is consumed by the average person in the course of a year.
Yeah, I don't know. I suspect that you get a kind of an uneven distribution. I think people who use sweetened sodas, you know, not diet sodas, probably skew us towards the high end because of that. And then everybody else is probably distributed down, and it probably has a lot to do with how many processed foods.
And what about diet drinks? Are there concerns relating to diet Pepsi or Coke or whatever diet drink?
Yeah, those ingredients have been shown to be safe. There is concern that generally when they're approved for a purpose. Then once they're in the food supply, they can be put anywhere. So people probably consume a lot more of them than they used to. There's some concern that it teaches us to expect, for instance, things to be sweet. But there isn't real strong evidence that if you use them, at least sparingly, that there's a problem.
Not everyone has access to food that are not as processed. I mean, it's kind of, we're getting at that. Or the time it always takes to make meals at home. What are some tips for choosing foods that are both convenient and good for you?
Well, you can check the ingredient list, look at the nutrition facts panel, and then some of it can be addressed by planning ahead. So if you have the ability to have things in your pantry or your freezer, having frozen or canned fruits and vegetables that you can use as if you don't have fresh or don't have access, or have them to cook with, or time, you know, convenience is tough. For many people, working and kids and activities, commuting, whatever it may be, you know, do you have time on the weekend to cook and freeze and just heat it up for dinner? Or do you supplement maybe you have time to steam vegetables for dinner that's fresh, but you pick an entree that's frozen. So you're balancing out, you know, in this particular meal, can I use a processed food and one that's less processed to help myself out?
Jeff Robbins, our technical director, has a reminder every day about what day it is for the year. And today is Happy National TV Dinner Day. And I heard on the radio this morning about TV dinners that were first, I think, today was the day that Swanson or whoever it was came out with their first TV dinner. And then it went on for about, they were called TV dinners for a few years, but then the companies wanted to change the name to something that sounded better. But TV dinner is stuck anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I haven't looked at TV dinners in quite a while. They've certainly evolved over time. There's certainly a variety. You can get ones that have targets to try to make them healthier, less fat, less sodium. And then you have some that are really targeted at big meals and people who, you know, are looking for something hearty. You know, I would want to read those labels carefully. But I think we see less TV dinners, perhaps, because there are, you know, quite a variety of other packaged foods that we can make up our own TV dinners, if you will. The idea of having to have, you know, four or five food groups all in one tray to heat in the oven isn't probably as prevalent as it used to be.
Well, it's there's certainly, if you go to Woodman's grocery store, there's an aisle that is about 100 feet long, and it's full of TV dinners down one side. And if you go down the other side of that same aisle, you've got at least 100 feet of pizza.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, pizza might be that ultimate TV dinner. And I think those are examples of what people would consider ultra-processed foods. And if we're consuming a lot of them, you know, we might not be getting enough of other things that we need. So certainly, you know, there's occasions and there's times where all those foods are helpful. You, even among those, you can maybe make some choices. So take a look at the two TV dinners and say, which one has more fiber? Which one looks like it actually has fruits and vegetables in it or whatever?
Jeff did a little research here. The Swanson TV dinner hit grocery store cases on September 10th of 1953. Ah. An immediate success in 1954, Swanson sold more than 10 million units. And the next year, it sold 25 million units.
Wow.
And then, of course, a lot of other people, companies got on board.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. It's an amazing amount. Beth Olson, our guest today, associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. Talking nutrition with her, we've been zeroing in a bit on ultra-processed foods, but taking other questions as well or comments, maybe your own experiences, love to hear from you. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller with my guest, extension specialist in nutritional sciences, Beth Olson, also an associate professor. It's great to have her back. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, the number's 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org. Some information, conservative estimate on the consumption of high fructose corn syrup indicates a daily average of 132 kilocalories for all Americans aged of greater than two. And the top 20% of consumers of caloric sweeteners ingest 316 kilocalories.
Yeah, that's, again, those probably top end might be heavy soda pop users or other sweetened beverages. That's, you know, a real common use. But small amounts of it are used in many products. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, we consume a fair bit of it.
Yeah, for sure. Jay in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jay.
Well, to replace ultra-processed foods, especially things with sugar and sweeteners, so-called natural but non-nutritional sweeteners like erythritol, stevia, monk fruit. I understand that some of those also have problems for diabetics, that or some may have heart health problems. I don't know if that's on topic enough. Is there anything you might have to say about somebody trying to cut down on sugar?
Mm. Yeah, and there's just been a proliferation of alternative sweeteners, so things besides sugar. Sometimes they're called artificial. Some of them promote themselves as being more natural. They are sugars that are modified, perhaps, so we don't absorb them as well. Or there's high intensity, so you can use just a tiny amount and get a lot of sweetness, and that's how they reduce calories. I think I would look at how people are using them. If you are a big soda pop consumer, sugared, and you're worried, maybe you start with a soda pop with artificial sweetener, and then maybe you alternate that with water. And so maybe it's a way to start reducing the sugars that you have in your diet. And then eventually, hopefully, replacing those calories, if you need them, with something healthier. So it might be milk or juice or tea or, you know, fruit, something else besides soda. But I do think we've talked so much about the dangers of sugars that we've almost promoted the use of other alternatives, which aren't always, you know, necessarily healthier.
For sure. Jay, thanks for calling. Chris and Adams, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I had a healthcare crisis in January where I almost died. My stomach started bleeding. And I had a long conversation with the doctor at the hospital, and I already had been on Dr. Weil's 10 things you should eat every day, minus the whole grains because I'm celiac, and I don't eat any processed foods. I never did. But all I did was shift my vegetable and fruit consumption to the 10 vegetables that you should eat every day. And the weight came off, and I lost 60 pounds. And I didn't even try. I wasn't hungry. Every time I felt a craving, I went for an orange or something, and a pineapple. And it just, it's been heaven, and I've got some more weight to lose, but I'm not worrying about it. One of the main problems is when you're on a diet and you're trying to lose weight is the anxiety that comes from the fact that you might put some sugar in your mouth or something. Anyway,
Chris, thank you so much for calling. Comments, Beth?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you're doing better. That's just wonderful to hear. Something I always think is kind of interesting about fruit is one of the dietary patterns recommended by the federal government in our dietary guidance, the Mediterranean diet and others, talk about desserts and how often they use fruit instead of something else. And, you know, she was mentioning reaching for a piece of fruit. A lot of fruit is very sweet, but it comes with fiber, with lots of nutrients. You know, look at the colors of fruits and vegetables. Those are all nutrients. Again, takes you a little longer to eat, chew. There are excellent alternatives to picking up something else with added sugar that might not have all those, probably doesn't have all those nutrients.
Yeah. Chris, thank you very much. Ben emailed, are vegan-specific ultra-processed foods, are there ones to stay away from, like tofu and similar products, or accidental vegan items like Oreos?
I think it's true of any food you label. Just because it has a label on it, gluten-free, vegan, even, you know, natural, doesn't mean the food itself is, you know, all that healthy. You just have to look at the ingredient list. You know, some people are concerned with not consuming animal products, and for them, some of these vegan products may be, you know, good alternatives. I would look at the ingredient listing. Some of the vegan products have a lot of what would be considered ultra-processed ingredients and be considered an ultra-processed food, and may not by default be better for you than the animal alternative.
Yeah.
But if you're choosing to not use animal products, they may be a good substitute.
Here's another email. Are frozen vegetables better for you than canned?
That's a good question. I don't know that they are. I would say that many people think they aren't as good as fresh, the frozen and canned. Often, or sometimes, be careful what I say here, vegetables or fruits are frozen in the field practically. I mean, very quickly, which preserves a lot of the nutrients. What you want to look for is what else might be in that package. So there are frozen vegetables with sauces added, so that's going to add, you know, calories and fat. There are fruits that are canned in heavy syrup, so they've got a lot of added sugar. So watch what is in the can and what is in the package. And then, again, those are great alternatives to fresh if you need them.
And I would think that there's, if you're canning, there's heat. And heat may have some degree on certain items that may be part of the, you know, vitamins or whatever that might be part of the vegetable.
Certainly, that could be true. What we will talk about often is if you have the choice, so, you know, a canned, you may prefer the fresh for that reason. If you're thinking about, well, I don't have anything to add to dinner except a canned vegetable, then add that. That's better than not having a vegetable. So I think they're good alternatives with some trade-offs.
Michael called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if you could address the processing degree of beer, wine, and distilled alcoholic beverage.
So I can't. I'm not an expert in alcohol. I would say when I've read some scientific articles on classifying alcohol, it was pretty complicated. So some alcohol fell in as an ultra-processed food and some did not. An alternative suggested by one nutritionist was simply to remove them entirely from the conversation. Treat them as a whole separate thing that you deal with in terms of their use in the diet and whether they're, you know, appropriate or not.
So when you go to the grocery store, there's a million things to choose from. What's the best approach for finding something good for you and that avoids some of the things we've been talking about?
So if you can, you know, it depends on where you're able to shop, how often you're able to get there. It's often been said, shop the outside of the aisles. That's where the fruits, vegetables, dairy products are. Down the center are going to be your packaged items that you might want to choose less of. I'd say look in the frozen section for things like frozen fruits and vegetables that you can use in cooking. And then after that, I'd say read the labels within the category of interest to you. If you want to eat ready-to-eat cereal because it's fast and, you know, in the morning, pick up something you think you'd like and then pick up other brands and take a look. Does it have fiber? How many calories does it have? Is it fortified? Same with breads. The same with soups. Pick it up and take a look. How much sodium? And compare within those and make the best choice that you can. And then take a look at, you know, the cost. That's a real concern for many people, especially these days. We're hearing grocery prices are high. And so can you find what's on sale and take a look? And maybe one week you pick a different vegetable because that's the frozen one that's on sale or the fresh one that's on sale versus another week.
You mentioned cereals. Mark had emailed us, where do Cheerios fall on the good foods scale?
Generally, they're, you know, pretty good food. They're made with oats. They're fortified, which in the U.S. diet, we rely on fortification for some of our vitamins and minerals. They're low in fat. Of course, for kids, they're good finger food. So it's actually a favorite snack in our house is Cheerios with milk.
Well, it's I kind of like Cheerios myself, as a matter of fact. Well, so the food pyramid.
Yeah, that's gone.
Yeah, is gone.
We grew up with the food pyramid. Before that, the basic four, you might remember. As we learned more, I think one of the things that happened, and this was true with the pyramid, we tried to cram everything into this one figure, and it got really confusing. And so now we have what's called My Plate, which is a pretty simple representation of fruits, vegetables, dairy, our basic food groups, and how much of each of those to have. And then we focus more on doing nutrition education to tell people how to put that into practice.
Well, Beth, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, I'll look forward to it, too. Thank you.
Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Science Department at UW-Madison. Great to have her with us. Just wanted to mention, tomorrow on the show, our team is traveling to La Crosse. We'll talk about the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. It's celebrating 100 years of conservation, and then we'll learn how the city of La Crosse is creating more opportunities for outdoor recreation. That's tomorrow. Coming up, though, we're going to talk about treatments for advanced heart failure. We'll talk with a doctor about that, and you'll learn more in just a couple of minutes. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News.